Because all through my high school years, like when we go to grade 8 and we talk about career and personal planning, they're like, okay, Cliff, what do you want to be? And I says, I want to be a helicopter pilot. And the teacher says, well, you're a foster kid, you can't do that. He said, choose plumber.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan here with Cardinal Aviation. Welcome to episode number 48 of the audio briefings. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really happy to have you here for another episode. And I am on time this week. It is Sunday. We're getting it out on time. So you're getting two within a short period this week. And I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. And we're going to be back to an interview format. And before I tell you about who we're going to be talking to, I got to tell you who this episode's brought to you by, and not Franz Flowers this week. This is going to be brought to you by flightcrew.ca. And as you know from some episodes past, flightcrew.ca is a division of or a part of Cardinal Aviation, and it's something that Owen Stacey and I are working together on. And Cardinal Aviation coach and consultant Blake Hache, who we talked about being a Airbus pilot who is currently on the sidelines because of COVID, who's working in the mine. We were talking resumes, we were talking networking, and Blake put together a fantastic program and a fantastic service that we are offering through flightcrew.ca. And basically, you can go online, you can submit your resume. It is a service that does have a fee, but again, this is Blake being proactive, doing something that is going to help himself a little bit, but more importantly, is going to help you spruce up your resume. We're going to get it down into a really nice, visually appealing one-page format. He's put together a fantastic guide to resume writing, which you will get a copy of. The other really interesting service that he's providing to go along with this, and it's an option, is he'll match your cover letter up with the resume, but the internet presence report, because social media is such a big part of our day-to-day lives right now, and you can bet yourself that any employer that is screening candidates once they've got out of the resume pile into the pile for consideration is going to be doing a Google search, is going to be searching the Instagram, the Facebook, the LinkedIn to learn a little bit more about you. And it is really easy to think that, you know, you've got a clean online presence and that, you know, your first impression is great. And while the resume may be your first impression, when they start Googling you, that's going to be your second and third impression before you even get a phone call. So if you go to flightcrew.ca, on the bottom of the page there, after you submit your resume to flightcrew.ca for us to use when operators do contact us to help pair pilots with jobs, there is options at the bottom to have your resume spruced up by our team. And our team is Blake, myself, and Owen. You can get the internet presence report if you like. And you can get your cover letter cleaned up. Now, when it comes to cover letters, though, really important to note, we are not going to change the content of your cover letter because that is a very personal thing. It is very indicative of who you are, how you speak. It's kind of like editing somebody's self-portrait. You are who you are, and we're just there to make it look good. The resume, on the other hand, we are going to go through and we will, you know, remove bits of information that maybe aren't so relevant. We'll make sure that the important bits are highlighted in the correct places so that the employer can see the relevant information quickly. So again, flightcrew.ca, if you need your resume cleaned up, the internet presence report, and get your resume in there. We are working on some really big stuff right now, and I can't really talk about it, but we're going to take flightcrew.ca global, and more information is going to be coming out about that down the road here once it comes available. But super, super excited about it, and it's killing me not to tell you. While you're on flightcrew.ca, which is all part of the Cardinal Aviation website, be sure to check out the Cardinal Aviation store if you're interested. There's some awesome t-shirts, hoodies, hats, stickers, pens, notebooks, all sorts of cool swag. You can follow us on Instagram at Cardinal Aviation. And if you enjoy the content that we're putting out, and I think you're going to enjoy this one, feel free to support the podcast. You can become an annual subscriber. You're going to get a thank you gift in the mail, your name mentioned on the next episode, lots of other neat benefits for annual subscribers. Or you can go ahead and buy us a coffee for your chosen amount, whatever it is, or even if it's just an email with your feedback. We just really appreciate your support. because it is so rewarding bringing this content out to you. And while you're there, check out the other services that Cardinal Aviation provides. We've got coaching by video or in the aircraft. We've got consulting. We do aircraft management, and we've got a team across the country. And like, let us know if we can't do it and I don't have somebody readily available. I will, mark my words, I will find somebody that is going to help you deal with whatever challenge it is that you need solved, be it paperwork or a flying issue, whatever it is. We're here to support you and to do it right. So that's a whole bunch of flightcrew.ca and Cardinal Aviation plugging. I'm just really proud of what it is we're trying to offer here, so I have to say it. But without any further delay, I want to get to my conversation with Cliff White. And I've known Cliff for about 9 years. Funny enough, we were neighbors at my old house before we moved. And great guy. I always knew he had a link to aviation. We, you know, kind of had like this common link in there. I never really dug deep and asked him about it, and I wish I would have earlier because, you know, we've kept in touch loosely over the years, and now he is pursuing a second career as a helicopter pilot. And he's going to tell you about what he was doing first. He's going to tell you about his transition to heli, but more importantly, and you're going to have to stick with us a little bit for this one, there is a backstory, and helicopters and aviation has been in his blood since he was born and since he was a young man, around 12 years old. There was an accident that involved his father, and there's some really important lessons to be learned here. And just in advance, before we even start, I just want to recognize and thank Cliff for being vulnerable, for sharing his story. It cannot have been easy. And I'm just lucky to have this guy as a friend, and he's going to go far in this business because just listen to him talk. This is somebody who gets it. This is somebody who is doesn't just say safety comes first. He lives it. He believes it. You know, he may be a helicopter student, but I think student pilots and licensed pilots could really learn something from listening to Cliff in this episode. Another fun fact is this is the first interview episode that I've done where both the interviewee and myself are having a conversation actually face-to-face using the same microphone in the same place. Cliff came over for dinner tonight. We had barbecue, a couple beers, and went into the office and decided to record this episode, and I'm so glad we did. So if the audio sounds a little bit different and there's a little bit of background noise, it's because this isn't the conventional we meet online, have a video chat, and I edit it down. This is basically a raw live conversation that Cliff and I had face to face in my office. So without any further delay, here's my conversation with Cliff White. Thank you, Cliff.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate it. And it's nice to hear the podcast. It's something I look forward to every time I release one on my commute into training. So it's nice to be here and get this one over and done with.
Over and done with. Yeah, we've been talking about doing this for a while, and you, you've been listening to them on your way into the school there in Abbotsford doing your heli training, and now we're sitting here in my house recording one. So, yeah, we go back 8-9 years, and we kind of loosely talked aviation like it was like I was living in it. You understood it, but it wasn't really, you were doing something else. So why don't we start with, you know, what were you doing, or what have you been doing? You're transitioning into heli, but what career are you moving out of? Because I think it's super interesting. Not a lot of people do it.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's, again, a long time coming that I was involved in industrial rope access from a fairly young age. I was about 20 years old when I got into that. And in BC and Canada in general, we didn't really recognize what we were doing as industrial rope access technicians. Most people think a window washer or a rock climber that's out there industrially to make money with skills of basically hanging on rope. And some of the projects that I got involved with were out of this world, to be totally honest. I rose up very quickly. I was at the forefront of a lot of change in that industry and kind of rode the initial wave. And now I've had, I went through a workplace injury last year while rigging for the Amazing Race Canada. Broke my leg pretty bad and kind of inhibited the future of climbing as a career path. So, you know, getting into aviation and getting into a little bit more office work and a little bit more sitting and the industry in general, but it's just been really interesting because the industrial rope access world did bring me to a lot of geotechnical locations, you know, between hydroelectric projects up BC's coast, and then BC Hydro themselves, all of their infrastructure inspections, maintenance, and initial construction, and then into working for the Coast Guard quite heavily for a number of years. So a lot of these sites that we were involved in, a lot of communication towers on remote islands and remote location. A lot of times there's no roads, so that kind of gets into the aviation aspect. You know, it kind of started with flying around from the airport to go to different locations, up to Yellowknife or, you know, up into Tuck, all over the place. So that, you know, once we get off the airplane and put boots on ground, we kind of transfer aircraft and jump into the helicopter and get to site. And it really has been, for many years for me, it's a work truck. I view it as such, and I'm really excited to kind of move from the back seat of that industry and being working underneath the machine to going into the front seat. And, you know, the shift from a passenger to a pilot's been super interesting. So I'm quite excited to this next chapter in life and, you know, talk about quite a few of the things that why I'm here at this point and how I got here for sure.
I don't want to dwell on your workplace injury, but you were doing industrial rope access. So you're hanging from ropes and ladders and scaffolding, sometimes like hundreds or thousands of feet in the air, to bust up your leg to the point where you could no longer do that job. You must've fallen off a pretty tall ladder, right?
Nope. It was the third rung.
So it was like, wait, you fell 3 feet.
Yeah, not even. It wasn't even a fall. It was a trip, a slip in a really interesting situation. You know, when I work with the Amazing Race Canada, the rigors that we bring in for that are next level. I don't know how many people really know about the Amazing Race Canada, but the rope-based stunts for the past 7 years I've been involved in as a rigger, into the lead rigger, into the lead supervisor, and testing, coordination with production, the whole thing. So yeah, there's like, we've done some crazy things with rope that, you know, scare the insurance companies, scare the production companies. And it's absolutely a wonder that they let us have the freedom and the creativity that we did in that. But that also definitely brings a lot of risk. So you say, like, you know, thousands of feet, you look back at the amount of times that I was under 100 feet and count them on a couple hands, you know. So
it's kind of like the old, if you're going to get in a car accident, it's going to be within 2 kilometers of your house. So if you're going to have a ladder fall and you're going to get hurt, it's probably going to be within 3 feet of the ground. So everybody be careful, be safe. So you'd mentioned that with the access work for Hydro and a lot of the projects that you're involved in, you spent a lot of time in the back of helicopters. They were like a truck to you. On Facebook, while you've been going through your helicopter training, you've been posting a lot of really cool photos that were always taken from the back seat while you were commuting in the helicopter, while it was taking you to a site. Are you putting that on your Instagram as well?
Yes and no. It's kind of, I'm a little bit weird like that. Some things I'll put on one, some things I won't put on the other. And I think it's, I don't honestly understand it myself.
It's funny though, because I'm looking at all your pictures and I'm kind of a ridiculous OCD picture taker too. And it looks like as a passenger, you probably have more helicopter experience than most helicopter pilots. So what's it like transitioning from the back seat to the front seat?
You know, I joke, it's pretty funny. A lot of my friends make fun of me and I say, it's going to be an interesting day when I surpass my passenger hours as a front seat pilot. That's going to take a while. And I really wish I had a better idea of how many hours I actually did as a passenger, but it's up there. I've done some significant flying. You know, we've gone from Prince Rupert all the way to Victoria in the helicopter. I've done some significant trips up in the north, multiple fuel stops, you know, lots of planning. It was interesting. It was the thing for me that really stuck out right off the bat was landing. You know, as a passenger, you're in the back seat, you're looking out the window at about a 45 degree angle to the ground, looking at the skid, watch it come in. We've had some extremely talented pilots, especially working with the Coast Guard. Some of those guys are just top-notch, tons of hours. And they got a really powerful machine that's got a lot of modern avionics. So going from a passenger looking at a skid and the stability that comes into especially a confined landing, and then going into the pilot seat, and the last thing you want to do is look at your skid and the ground at a 45 through the bubble. So, you know, it was very calm in the first couple hours. My instructors, eyes up, eyes up, eyes up. It's always eyes up. Anywhere you're near the ground, eyes up. Do not look at the ground. You know, look at your spot. Understand where the helicopter is. Understand where your tail rotor is. And that was a hard one, too. The tail rotor is way behind you. You know, a lot of people don't really realize, but, you know, when you're trying to pass things. So eyes up was a big thing. That was the transition for me. I did have a couple hours. I did intro flight with Misha there at BC Helicopters years ago. So I kind of knew what to expect. But again, going back into the back seat, we're talking for significant hours of transit and transport and logistics management with that, with the Coast Guard. It was crazy.
So after having like probably a couple thousand hours sitting in the back seat of a helicopter, you're watching these guys fly and you're probably thinking, man, that looks pretty easy. Like, it can't be that hard. I mean, look, like I'm sitting here, I've been watching these guys for 1,000 hours. I'm pretty sure just by watching, I could figure out how to do it. So when you first, like your first lesson or two, when you decided to pursue it, what was the thing that you thought was going to not be that hard? And you're just like, okay, I was wrong.
Well, the big thing is, you know, flying in 212s, 214s, 407s, you know, it's very rare that we had those maxed out for weight. Coast Guard machines, they did get a bunch of new machines. They've got a lot of modern avionics and a lot of stuff on them that does jack the weight up. But overall, they have just tons of power. And then stepping into a Bell 47 with zero power available, it's a totally different thing. So, you know, when we're doing vertical takeoffs in those 412s and stuff, and just the maneuvering and the capability and the stability that you have when you have that extra, like, amazing amount of power available compared to something like a Bell 47 where, you know, I could be wrong, but it feels like you only have 10 horsepower to deal with once the thing's in the air. And it's actually... was a huge wake-up call. It was a very quick shift from understanding that, you know, you can watch somebody from the back seat, but till you put your hand on the cyclic and the other one on the collective with the throttle and balancing all that stuff, there's nothing like it. It's a machine that I have a ton of respect for. And I didn't realize that until I got into the front seat. You know, that was a big change for the respect aspect. You know, it went from being a cool machine, something that was just like super enjoyable, into something that literally is a work truck. And that's really my main focus here, is to keep that it's a work truck and have the respect that, you know, that it's brought for me in life and everything.
So we're sitting here, it's September 19th, 2020, the year that we all wish would just end. you started, you're going like full on getting this thing done. What was it 2 months ago?
Yeah, flat out. I'm pretty much about 10 or about 10, 12 weeks in now. So I'm getting up to third month.
Okay, so third month, and you've put in how many hours?
I'm just going to crack 60 hours in the next flight or two here.
Sweet. So he's got to get to 100 to get the commercial done. So yeah, like, I mean, you'll be done by the end of the year, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to take a week or two off in between that, and then I'll go back for my 206 endorsement. And I'm really toying with the idea of kind of seeing what the industry's at and possibly doing my fixed wing conversion as well. While I'm kind of in learning mode, especially at the airport, and getting used to the circuits and the tower and all that stuff in the area, it seems to be something I might end up doing for sure.
So you spent a bunch of time sitting in the back of helicopters for work. What was it for you that made you decide that when you're going to make you had your injury, you're going to make a career switch to aviation? Why helicopters and not fixed wing?
Because we can go backwards.
Because you go backwards.
I don't know. That's a good one. I think I'm not a pavement guy. Everything that I've done, you know, we get it into the airplane at YVR. We fly to Yellowknife as soon as you're on a plane. You get into the helicopter and it's a bush site. Everything, or the vast majority, I don't think I've ever actually landed at for work a concrete pad. It's always been, you know, leaving from a base and spending the day out there, or getting dropped off and being left to camp. Or whatever thing. So that the bush aspect, I'm, you know, born and raised BC. I spent a lot of time up north. I'm just not a city guy. So I'm the kind of dude, you know, that the further north you send me, the better off I'm going to be for sure. So, you know, keep me away from the pavement. And that's, you know, going into the bush world in airplanes, you got to gain a bunch of experience. You can't just let a new pilot go have at it in the bush. So I did consider the float plane aspect, but with a knee that's not as stable as it should be and not as quick on my feet, I just imagine myself falling in front of clients into the lake and just being like, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, you fell off a 3-foot ladder. I think the rungs on the beaver from the float up to the cabin is about 3 feet as well. So you'd be...
Oh, it's super embarrassing. Yeah, it is an interesting thing because, yeah, my experience is at extreme heights are, you know, and 3 feet is something else. But, you know, sometimes it is the simple thing.
You got a pretty sweet tattoo there. Can we add like just 3 foot on there somewhere?
Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to talk to my tattoo guy, see what he thinks.
Yeah. So that was the easy answer. Why'd you get into helicopters? Because they can go backwards and you like the bush thing. But yeah. You have a deeper tie to helicopters.
Yeah, for sure. You know, my entire life, it's kind of funny to say, but I was in a helicopter before I was even born. You know, I talked to my mom recently about it, and she said, you know, your dad finished his license there. The first flight that he kind of was able to take family, we went into Hell's Gate with a 206. And my grandpa was a really big dude. He passed away at about 300, 320 or so. Maybe even more. He might have even been bumping 360. So, you know, he couldn't take a full load with the Jet Ranger. He probably had to sit in the back by himself. And lucky enough, my mom got a ride in the front seat. So, you know, that is it's an interesting thing because one of the most calming, I guess, sounds is the start of a turbine. It's been, you know, ingrained in me as a kid. When my dad's first job was as up in Norman Wells, flying for Canadian Helicopters in the late 80s on seismic. So we lived in the helicopter hangar in Norman Wells as children with that, and that's kind of how it worked up in the north back then. So, you know, living in the same thing, the smells, burnt Jet A, you know, the whole nine yards. And, you know, so I have been a pilot's kid since day one. And, you know, unfortunately, many years down the road in his career, he did, you know, have an incident, an accident, and passed away from that. So it was super tough. I was 12 years old. You know, I was unfortunately living in a foster home at the time. My mom and dad separated years before that. So just kind of going from a transition as into that, and then losing my dad. And, you know,
in a helicopter accident.
Yeah, in a helicopter accident. And that's, you know, kind of what we're here to talk to about is the simple things. This is a, you know, something that happened. And a lot of times, especially with a helicopter, people's automatically first thing is, oh, mechanical failure. You know, it's 1,000 pieces spinning around.
Well, we were just talking. You showed up to my house tonight for dinner and you brought my son a Lego. And so it's Lego and you can build a helicopter. And they finished building it and there was a couple pieces left over. I said, well, there can't be extra pieces. I mean, if you follow the instructions, there's no extra pieces. And then we realized it's just realistic. There's always parts left over on the ground around the machine. So, but not really.
Yeah, definitely. So that was, you know, I've dealt with that a lot of times. A lot of people, so the first thing they say is, oh, what happened to the helicopter? You know, and unfortunately it wasn't that. It was something quite a bit smaller. So it's a really interesting shift for me to, you know, process that, move forward and use it as a lesson. And I've talked to especially the other students in class right now, you know, and I try and give them the perspective that this is, you know, this is a work machine, this is a work truck. It's not, you know, helicopters can be fun, but if you're looking at it as a career pilot, this is a very serious thing. So the story is, you know, the small things count. And unfortunately, you know, I hurt myself. It was pretty embarrassing, and I'm pretty sure my dad would say the exact same thing if you asked him about that. You know, it's one of those things. So basically, my dad was flying career pilot BC many years. He was working for Northern Mountain Helicopters, and they kind of had a bit of a relationship with VIH back in the day. That was 1997 when this happened. And they got a fire suppression contract down in Chile. And he went down to go fly there, did an 8-month contract, was super successful, had a great time. And unfortunately, basically the last day that he did was on contract to fly, last flight of the day, coming in for approach and got clearance. That's kind of when everything, you know, went sideways for him. And this really boils down to decision making before you close the cockpit door. You know, he was a tall guy, about 6 inches, 4 inches taller than me, so he's a good 6'6", 6'8". Many people in Chile, they're quite short, definitely not that tall, so their structures are as such. So door frames down there are a different story. So unfortunately, you know, in the investigation and as it comes out, you know, it was pilot incapacitation, reason inconclusive, and it kind of got traced back to, unfortunately, he hit his head a few times, and that's kind of where things started. It was noted multiple times.
Sorry, like hit his head in like turbulence?
No, on the door frame.
Oh, just like on his way in and out of the helicopter?
No, of the house that he was staying.
Okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. So, like, I've known you for 9 years. I knew your dad passed away in a helicopter accident in Chile. I know that much.
Yeah.
But we've never talked about the story why. So he's in Chile, he's in a crew house or whatever, the door frames are lower, he bonked his head a bunch of times walking through a door in a house, not in a... I just want to make sure this is super clear.
Yeah.
A door in a house, not a helicopter.
You got it.
Now he's in a helicopter flying.
You got it.
And?
Delayed concussion.
So he's flying along and bonking his head on the doors and the house caught up.
You got it. Yeah, so basically, you know, up until that, he was there for 8 months, and there's 12 specific times that did happen. It's embarrassing to say that. There's 12 times where you have, you know, an opportunity to step back. And, you know, we have this tendency as a man or being the only pilot there, feeling responsibility, or these guys can't go to work if I don't. And there's all that stuff plays into it. So, you know, he should have not shook it off. But, yeah, basically, there's multiple factors medically that kind of come into that. There's numerous terms that we can say that cause it. But yeah, basically, you know, he hit his head and it kind of came out, unfortunately. And I didn't have a lot of people ask it, does it have to do with altitude? And I says, well, Chile obviously goes from sea levels to the top Andes in a split second. But no, it was just an unfortunate event. So yeah, he went out on his last flight to go pick up some firefighters. He landed, asked them if they needed some water bucketing done before they left to do some mop-up. And they said, no, let's get out of here. So everybody loaded up. Chileans are small, so, you know, they were flying an A-Star. There was two guys in the front, and it sounds like four people in the rear, in the back seat, crammed in the thing, and they went back, and they were about 10 kilometers south of base. He did power check, reported power check, reported inbound, got clearance, and basically lowered collective to start his approach, and that was it. Reports say the guy in the front seat seen him basically slump over. That physical motion kind of introduced a very slight amount of right cyclic. It was already in the descent, so it didn't really pitch forward enough that they noticed that something was wrong until they were clipping trees. So
he was incapacitated. Like, sorry, I don't want to like dig up details because tough, but sorry, but you just said the guy in the front seat said he saw, which means that people survived the accident.
You got it. So four passed away and two survived. Yeah. The crazy part is I met those people and I look identically like them. So it was a really tough thing. So, you know, so that's it. So the report does say, you know, they noticed pilot slump over, but when you sit in a helicopter, what does a pilot do when they're on approach? You know,
they look
out the window. They're looking around. They're very focused. You don't talk to them. You don't question them. They started kind of skipping above the treetops, and then they knew something was wrong. So basically, aircraft was continuing its descent, bellied down into a river that was about 4 to 5 feet deep, skipped quite hard across the rocks and stuff they found, you know, disturbed algae, disturbed rocks, underwater level. The front right skid hooked something and basically turned it into a flat spin into the bank. The rotor hit the bank, transmission and rotor went into the cabin. Tail boom came off, and tail boom was a long ways away. It was about 120 meters away.
Holy.
So, you know, super indicative of power on,
yeah,
you know, on crash. So nothing was wrong with the helicopter, but, you know, something's wrong with the decision making of the pilot to put themselves in that position.
But I mean, if we go back to the 90s, I mean, I played rugby, you probably played contact sports, like you hit your head,
Man up.
Yeah, man up. Get your, you know, once the world stops spinning, get back in the game. I mean,
you got it.
We didn't have the awareness to brain injury and multiple concussions that we have now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so, I mean, it's, I think, I mean, in your dad's defense, and I don't know, I don't know him.
Sure.
You know, I think it's easy for us to say, you know, bad, we can always make different decisions, whether or not they were good or bad. You know, we talk about, again, resulting, like, is only as good as the information we have surrounding it. If we didn't know about concussions, we can't make a good decision about concussions. But I mean, yeah, like, we talk about pilot incapacitation.
You got it. And it was a big deal because, you know, from the reports and stuff, it's really difficult for an investigator just to say inconclusive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's difficult for them to take a body and do a coronary autopsy and not find something wrong. You know what I mean? And the unfortunate part of that, and I've actually talked about the helmet thing too, this is a big deal, is, you know, they wouldn't have really had as much of a clue if he wasn't wearing a helmet. The rotors did come into the cabin, and unfortunately, like we all as a pilot should understand, that those blades flex, and when they're moving that fast, it becomes in the cabin, you got a really low chance of surviving that. So unfortunately, it was an incapacitation that was an unfortunate decapitation. So that's, you know, that's kind of where that ended up, and there's just no way you can't survive that. So, you know, when the helicopter did stop, it was on fire. There was a guy with a broken leg, the one guy that was minorly injured or not injured as much. He pulled them all out, so nobody burned, nobody had you know, further complications from that. But the simple fact of the matter is, when a helicopter hits the ground, it's violent.
Mm-hmm.
It is a thing for sure. But on the Transport Canada side of things and the investigators in Chile, they, you know, they were super baffled until it came out that a couple people were like, well, the guy hit his head a few times. Like, he, you know, there was these instances where we're like, oh, dude, are you okay? You know, that was a thing. And it was enough that it was brought up. So that goes back, you know, when Transport Canada comes back here from the investigation, they kind of look for other things to kind of explain this and say, like,
possible or probable cause.
You got it. So they have, you know, it kind of, they really pointed to a term called vasovagal syncope. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, it basically for us means delayed concussion, right? It's a condition that, you know, comes up and in a normal person's life that, you know, he just might have passed out.
Yeah, you just faint.
Yeah.
That's the same term they used. I got up in the middle of the night one night, actually at work. I was on a midnight shift, and I was having my nap in the middle of the shift, and I got up and I went, and, you know, you've shared a lot of personal stuff on here, so I'll get personal too. I got up in the middle of the night, I went to the bathroom, and I was using the urinal. Right. And you take off, like, you wake up and you stand up too quick and your blood pressure drops. Sure. And then when you are in the bathroom and you release, it actually drops your blood pressure further. And the next, I don't know if it was 5 minutes or 10 minutes later, but I woke up face down on the bathroom floor at work with a bloody eye because I smoked my head on the way down on the countertop.
Absolutely.
And ended up at the hospital that night. And that vasovagal syncope or whatever is the exact same term they used for that. It's like probably be brought on by multiple concussions, but it's basically like you fainted.
Yeah, and this you can go kind of one step further in medical terms in a cerebral edema, basically, you know, pooling of blood between membrane layers in your brain, and it causes pressure. And when the pressure gets enough, you know, it does come out in small symptoms, but as a man, again, you kind of shake them off.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the closest instances that Transport Canada had to kind of relate to this was very, very similar. You know, a ferry flight happened, a two-day ferry flight. The pilot, he was actually playing football with his son, hit his head, shook it off, same thing. And it was actually his son in the end that told the investigators what happened, and same thing. They're like, oh, well, that's what it had to be. But he complained of numbness and tingling in his left hand, took a couple Tylenol, shook it off, went to sleep. It was an interesting story because he was on a ferry flight in Canada and stopped at his parents' house with permission from operator en route. You know, his parents were like, oh, a little concerned. Why, you know, you shouldn't be taking Advils or whatever before you fly. So he didn't. You know, complained of numbness and tingling, and he was about 30 miles out of out of destination and called into Flight Service Center. And this is kind of one of the interesting ones, because when he made his position report, Flight Service basically was like, hey, you're garbled, like you're very strong, but you're garbled. And there was five times that they said that to him, and he just said, oh, it's got to be the radio, you know. And they're like, something ain't right. 30 minutes, the guy's in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so same thing, cerebral edema, pooling of the blood, got enough that it put enough pressure on his brain to make him pass out. So he landed in the trees, and he actually lived, they assume, for 3 hours after he landed. When RCAF went and parachuted in there, they said, unfortunately, he was passed away. But they were able to go backwards and say, yeah, he was actually alive for 3 hours before his brain finally.
This kind of goes back to our conversation again with Gord several weeks ago. And, you know, we talk about awareness when it comes to like our psychological state. How are we feeling? What are we thinking? But also our physiological state. What are we physically feeling? What are some, you know, wow, my left hand's never been tingly before, and this doesn't feel right. There's probably a reason. And I've shared lots of stories. Like, if your gut says something's different, there's a reason why it's different.
We got to figure out why. Yeah. You wouldn't take off in a plane with something like, oh, this feels so crazy, like in a helicopter, you see a Jizo, you wouldn't just like fly away.
Yeah. It's like, I've never smelt that smell before. Ah, it's probably fine.
Yeah.
Exactly. But really, Cliff just had a wicked lunch. So, no. Cool. Well, yeah, I appreciate you sharing all of that, because that can't be easy. But I think talking about it is important. And hopefully people that are listening to this can see the lessons in there, whatever they want to take of it, because there's a lot of them. But also, I mean, it's been 23 years since that happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure you didn't talk about it openly for a very long time, but
no,
what, like, not. What, two questions, and these kind of difficult questions. At what point after that were you like, one day I'm going to fly helicopters, versus, you know, I'm sure there was a while where you're like, I want nothing to do with helicopters. So when did that switch? And at what point did you actually start being comfortable talking about it and telling the story? Cause I'm sitting across from you, I can tell it's difficult. So like, when did that kind of switch?
I don't know, to be honest. Like, I really remember my dad flew for Helijet when we moved back from Norman Wells onto the coast. And I remember sitting at South Terminal there and watching him take off in a Helijet for service to Victoria. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. Through high school and like my younger years, I did, you know, unfortunately, my parents divorced. I ended up in foster care. So, you know, it is limited in a lot of things, but it also did bring a lot of good things. But it's interesting, because all through my high school years, like when we go to grade 8 and you talk about career and personal planning, they're like, okay, Cliff, what do you want to be? And I says, I want to be a helicopter pilot. And the teacher says, well, you're a foster kid, you can't do that. He said, choose plumber. And I was just like, really? Like, this is crazy. And he flat out said, you know, you're a foster kid and that's not going to happen. So, you know,
that's all the fuel you need, right?
There wasn't, you know, there's never been a time where I didn't think that I was going to be a pilot, for sure. There's been times where my family was really against that, understood it, you know, and definitely supported me, but I'm sure that, you know, there's lots of background with that I don't understand or don't see. But I've always wanted to be a pilot. It's always been a thing. You know, I started my last company specifically to get in a financial position that I could pay for my license and get that done and dealt with. And I did really well in business. And this is kind of one of the outcomes of it. I did get to where I want to be. So, you know, it's not that I want to be a career pilot. I'm not going to strive to have 15,000 hours when I quit. I am going to strive to, you know, have a career in aviation. I really want to be a base manager. And that's how I want to retire. You know, this industry is really hard to go into and leave. You know, I've met lots mm-hmm. of people that have either taken training and not succeeded, or been a pilot and then gone through a turndown and then just said, screw it. You know, I got a kid, I got this, I got all kinds of stuff, and they leave, and you see, it breaks their hearts. You know, it's a lifelong thing. So for me, the people and the places that I've gone with this industry, you know, it's certainly not about the money. I took a massive pay cut to kind of come go backwards, and I joke all the time. I say, yeah, I just gave up on life. I'm just going to fly helicopters now.
What?
you know, but...
You mentioned the foster care a couple times now, and what a teacher said to you about, well, you're a foster kid. There's no way you're ever going to be a helicopter pilot. Yeah. You know, and then you, and then after that, I just think it's really cool that you, I just want to go back to that, that you said, then I, you know, my last company I started and I did really well so that I could get in a position to, where I could get my license. What, I mean, if there was a 16-year-old kid listening to this, who's, you know, in a, in foster care, in whatever it is, like whatever is going on in life, like it's just, they're, are challenges and predisposed societal roadblocks.
Absolutely.
What would you say to that person that, you know, definitely might stereotypically have an uphill battle to achieve their dream? So say the teacher or whatever it may be.
You got to find a mentor. Yeah. You got to find somebody that cares. You know, cause you can't do everything yourself, especially when you're young. And if you don't have parents, you know, especially something like this, this is a really tough thing to get into financially, and you have to have a ton of drive. That's really all there is to it. Nobody gets in the, you know, very few people get into this because they had the money just to go dump $100,000 on a license. Like, that's not reality. And that's, you know, I'm super fortunate that I'm at a place where I don't have to struggle huge with that, especially in 2020 when it's just such a disaster of a year for everybody else. So it's a huge, you know, it's a life changer. And if this is midlife crisis for me at 36, I'll take it. You know, this is about as good as it gets. But finding mentors, they're out there. You know, the people do care. You gotta find, you really just have to find somebody that cares. Someone that's gonna help you make goals and reach them. That's a, you know, as a man, we're nothing without a goal. So man without a plan is not a man at all. I say that all the time. So
that's a, you know, and you have to really want it. I think if, you know, if somebody said to you, you can't do it, I mean, that's gonna light a fire under your ass. Like, I'm gonna show you.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, especially these kids, like they're so used to being told no, 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 no. I hate to say it, but that sets you up really well for this industry. Cause if you're going to make it in this industry, you have to be like really, really okay with and really used to being told no and to keep plugging along. Right.
Yeah. You got it. And that's where passion comes in. You know, everybody gets into flying for different reasons, but you know, I do believe there's very few people that come into it kind of the same approach and same angle as I do. And I really want to make it clear that, you know, to me, the helicopter is a work truck. You know, that is, has always been, you know, our method of work. I could never gotten nowhere that I've got without both rope and a helicopter. And those tie together really well. Like, a lot of my career has been bringing engineers into locations that they shouldn't be themselves. So now that's just kind of changing a little bit into being a pilot of a machine where you're taking people where they can't go themselves. Mm-hmm. And the responsibility that comes along with that, you know, when you talk about going from the back seat to the front seat, you know, and now in the last 10 hours, I'd say especially, my mindset has shifted from it's me solo in the helicopter or it's me and my instructor. And if I screw up, my instructor is going to save me. Now I got to start shifting to like, it's me and people in the back seat. You know, if I make bad decisions, that doesn't just affect me. You know, going solo in a helicopter, you know what it's like. You're just out. It's freedom. And like, if you make a mistake, it's all on you. It's 100% you. But, you know, shifting to the pilot and then into that kind of mentalities, you know, that's where I'm at.
Right. You're now ahead of me on the heli training. By a good chunk. I haven't flown in 2 weeks now, and my heli training is probably going to take a little. It's probably going to slow down here a little bit because there's some other things going on which we're not going to talk about today. But on it, like, you're right. Everything you just said is right. And I feel, especially the last couple of flights, like I feel like prepared, but at the same time, every time I pull collective to take off, I'm like, this could be the last takeoff I ever do. There's just that little bit of.
Absolutely.
That I never feel that when I push in throttle in an airplane.
Yeah. You know, and it goes back to it. It's like, you know, I've had lots of people say like, how does that affect you? Like, you know, every time you jump in that thing, do you not think about it? And I say, you know, as weird as it is to say, like, I actually don't. I don't think about that anymore. And you know, somebody that, you know, I've just met in life, has kind of had that concern. You say, you know, like, I think about that every time you say you're going flying. It's like you hit that starter and, like, man, helicopters sometimes don't even get off the ground, and, you know, ground resonance just shakes apart and unfortunate things happen.
Yeah, but those are the only videos that make it onto YouTube.
Yeah. So, you know, and I said to her, you know, this is just one of those things that I have to trust myself and my focus now. Like, I can fly the machine. There's, you know, that it's not that it's easy, but, like, I see it as, like, yeah, there's that. It's all about pilot decision making, and I've been making high risk decisions for years, and I have to step back just to touch, because a helicopter is such a dynamic machine, and a lot of my work in the past has been very proactive, and that also goes into helicopter. You have to be three steps ahead of the machine, or, like you said yourself on one of the podcasts, like, you turn into a passenger in the blink of an eye.
Right.
Cannot, not fun. You cannot let the helicopter do that. You can't be a passenger when you have a stick in your hand. And that's the thing. It's like making sure that you're always three steps ahead and thinking about what's going to happen. Where's my safe place? How am I going to go, you know, get back to where is safe? Not only location on the ground if you have issues, but, you know, it's just things like speed on approaches and balancing power. And I'm really glad that I'm dealing with the Bell 47. I'm a big dude. I'm 225 pounds. My instructor's 200 pounds. We basically have 20 pounds. So I joke all the time, but, like, we're literally working with, you know, like, I don't know, maybe 10, no more than 15 horsepower. So it's a skill thing. My instructor says all the time, all the skill is in your right hand. It's in the cyclic, because there's nothing in your left. The collective has nothing. There's nothing there. So it's very common. He says, do not exceed the limits of the aircraft because you don't have the skill in your right hand. That's why I like flying this, because, you know, the day that I jump into an A-Star and there's literally endless power.
Is that your is that your goal machine? What's your one thing?
I'll just say flat out, like, you know, when you say that, there's a couple turning points, and last October was a big one for me, actually. Coldstream Helicopters, they got another Super Puma in there. I'm from Vernon. I was just like, man, seeing that thing in the valley. I gotta say, like, the other part is that big helicopters have leather seats and they got AC.
Yeah.
So, you know,
and eventually, big guys sweat.
Yeah, for sure. Super Puma 332, or like a Sikorsky Skycrane, like anything big. I'm a big dude. I want to get in there, but I want to get in at the bottom. I want to support that. I want to fly 206. I want to get into that. I want to start flying A-Stars. You know, I'd love to jump in a MD-500. Like, those things just look like insane. Yeah. Tons of power, super handful.
Intro to MD-500 was, like, the police helicopter in Speed with Sandra Bullock and Tom Cruise.
Yeah, they literally are just the Lamborghinis of the world. Yeah. So, yeah, of course I want to fly a 500. And that's a BC Coast machine. You know, I got a good, really good buddy. And every time he gets picked up in a 206, he just curses, like, there's nobody business that it's not the right machine for.
Just because we've been there before with this podcast, he's talking about a Bell 206, not a Cessna 206.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, underpowered, and he's just like, every time they come, he's like, this is bad. So the 500, you know, in BC, it's the machine. So I think there's a certain street cred that comes with being a pilot in BC and having some hours on a 500. You know, that's like, it's kind of akin to it. I could only imagine going from a student pilot, getting a license, and going straight to a 500. That'd be just phenomenal, you know. But right now, you know, I'll do my 206 Jet Ranger endorsement and take it from there. And I really want to go from the bottom up, and I want to, you know, learn the industry, and my background in occupational health and safety is going to be a big asset. And I do see a huge change. You know, I haven't been in the industry long enough, but I do feel every industry is going through changes in safety management systems. And I really want to be involved in that, you know. The report that I got from Northern Mountain Helicopters, Jared Dennis was their investigator for the accident of my dad. And, like, the key thing that he said was basically that, you know, if my dad was here and there was anything you were going to ask him about this, what would it be? And he would say that, I want others to learn from this,
mm-hmm.
You know, and just being here, you know, there's going to be lots of people listening to that. It really is about the small things. So as I progress in my career, not only as a pilot, but as a hopeful occupational health and safety aspect in an operation, you know, that's a big deal. And I want to be able to tell people, you know, this is small things. They sometimes are a really big deal. So
cool. Well, you know, I think, I don't know. I shouldn't put this on a CD because nobody has a CD player anymore, but I'm going to put this on a USB drive for you, and forget the paper resume. I think you could probably just send any employer a recording of this, and I think we got your interview covered. So That was amazing. Thank you very much for sharing a lot of really personal stuff. Be it, you know, childhood, your dad's accident, in such detail. And, you know, part of that, I was like, oh, I don't know if that we leave that in here, but we have to leave it in here because it's real. And it is, we can't sugarcoat the risks.
No,
we can't sugarcoat what can really happen. Yep. We have to manage them. We have to respect them. And yeah, I just, thank you. I lived next to you for, I think, 3.5 years, 8 years ago. I never heard that full story. I just knew, helicopter Chile and yeah, because you'd mentioned he worked for Helijet, and that time when I lived next to you, I was working for Helijet. That was kind of like our connection.
Sure.
But I wish I would have asked more questions. I'm not a pry ask questions type of guy. You're a guy. Like, my wife always goes, oh, what's going on with his, you know, relationship? Like, it's not my business. I don't ask questions. I don't care.
No, that's going good.
It's not my damn business. Yeah. Oh. So, you know, if I learned something in Gord's mindfulness course there that I did the last 2 months, it was to approach things with curiosity.
Absolutely.
And I need to work on finding that balance personally of being curious and being intrusive, because I wish that I would have asked you more about this 8 years ago, that we could have connected on that, or that I would have.
You know, that
would
have been tough though. Every time I tell the story, it gets a little easier, but it's not easy stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm a firm believer, if nobody shares, nobody learns. And I think,
totally.
You know, with the Cardinal podcast, that's a pretty key aspect of this. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you've said those exact words many times. Nobody shares, nobody learns. That's what we're here for.
Totally. And you know what, if nothing else, if you don't become a base manager, which I'm sure you will, I think you'll make one hell of a awesome helicopter instructor once you get some field time under your belt. So anyway, thank you. Thanks for coming here for dinner tonight. Thanks for bringing chicken. Thanks for bringing my kids Lego. And thanks for spending 45 minutes here telling your story. I'm probably gonna stay up late tonight and get this edited and out tomorrow. Cliff, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. I really appreciate it. And keep it up. You know, this is like everybody I know in aviation, especially students, that says, you guys got to listen to this. You know, at $10 a minute in a helicopter, things like the ditch, the kneeboard one, as soon as I'm ready, it's just like, as soon as that controller's telling me my squawk, it's in. I don't write nothing down. I really
focus. Do people actually use kneeboards in helicopters?
No, I'd make fun of them. Actually, I think we got
what are you gonna write with? What are you gonna write with?
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of those things. But
You know what? I'll close off with this. My last solo flight, I had my iPad on a suction mount to the side of like the bubble on the cabri, and I'm thinking like, okay, cool. Like, I don't want to get distracted. I just want to do my thing. But I had the iPad there, and I was thinking like, the angle is really good for the back-facing camera, and I'm like, if I can just get it onto video record mode, I'm just going to let it run for the flight, and then maybe I have a little bit of video to review after for debrief or whatever. I tried 3 times to let go of the collective, to like go and like swipe and open up the camera and get the video going, and every time I did it, the helicopter's like on its side, and I'm like, whoa, no.
Yeah. 200 feet's gone.
Yeah, man, like anybody looking from the outside would think I was hammered, and then I just figured I don't need a video that badly, so... Anyway, all right. Thanks, Cliff, and I will see you at the airport hopefully soon.
Yeah, get on it, bud.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
There you have it. There's my conversation with Cliff White. Awesome guy, awesome friend. I'm so fortunate to have happened to live next to him 9 years ago, and here we are sharing something that we have in common, aviation, whether it's heli, whether it's fixed wing. At the end of the day, it is just aviation, and it just goes to show that absolutely everybody has a story, and everybody's experience is different. Everybody's reason for doing what they do is different, and they're all valid. They're just very personal and different, and I'm so honored that Cliff was willing to open up to me, open up to all of you, to share his background, his story, his experience, so that we can learn some very valuable lessons. All right, I did all the plugging at the beginning, so I'm going to spare you now. All I'll say is, if you want to get in touch with us, info@cardinalaviation.ca, online, www.cardinalaviation.ca, and on Instagram, @cardinalaviation. If you want to support the podcast, you can do that on the website. I appreciate your time. Thank you for joining me. And until next time, Fly safely. Never stop learning. Take care of yourself.